It's Essential Pittsburgh. I'm Paul Guggenheimer. The MacArthur Genius Grants were announced this week. Included among the 21 recipients is University of Pittsburgh professor and poet Terrence Hayes. He spoke with WESA Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson, who began by asking Hayes if he had hoped to one day win a MacArthur Grant.
The sort of annual game around my home, because my wife is also a writer, is to think about who might get it. So one writer I thought about was actually a University of Pittsburgh professor a few years ago named Ben Lerner. So I'd said to my wife, maybe in August, I think he had a new book come out. I was like, oh, Ben would be a good candidate for the MacArthur. And there's another woman in Brooklyn who's this interesting saxophone player. So I've always been aware of it, but I've always thought about it in terms of guessing who they were going to pick. So that when they called me the previous week, I didn't recognize the number. I saw on my phone that there was a number from Illinois. And I just said, I don't know anybody that lives in Illinois. So I didn't answer. And then it immediately rang on my house phone, first my cell, then the house phone, and I still didn't answer it. So the next week when they called, I saw the number, and I still didn't answer it. So this is the third time that the number's coming through. But I decided to call them back. So I saw it ring. I was in the coffee shop, and then I called it back, and no one answered. So I thought, this is weird. I think somebody's, you know, playing a trick on me. And then they immediately called back, and they said, this is the MacArthur people. So, no, I certainly wasn't expecting the call. So it was certainly a big surprise.
Certainly, even though there are no formal strings attached to this, as they say, no stipulations, no reporting requirements, presumably the MacArthur people see big things for you and expect you to do something remarkable with this opportunity over the next 5 years. I wonder if you've had a chance to think how you'll take advantage of this.
Well, you know, what's interesting is that I've always tried to separate honors. And I think I've been, you know, pretty fortunate in terms of validation for my work. And I've always tried to think about the poem in front of me and, you know, maybe the last poem I've written. So I don't even really think about books as I publish them. By the time they're in the world, I'm on to the next thing. And that keeps me from really taking prizes too seriously because, you know, it's always hard. It's always work to make the next poem. So the problem with this one is that they're really giving it for future work. So it's very hard to kind of separate it from from past work or sort of say it will have no impact. So I really don't know. It's really a new space for me to think about, well, what can I do with this? Because I typically really separate them. And the most tangible thing that I think about in terms of my working process is that I like to be busy. I like to be in the classroom. I write at night. So during the daytime, I'm driving my kids around and doing all kinds of regular things. And so I've really shaped my life in a way that doesn't require too much extra. So it's a challenge, but it's not a bad challenge. My daughter would say that it's a first world problem to figure out how to make use of the money. But it is a new space, so I really can't even say. I mean, it's a challenge, but it's not a bad challenge to figure out what'll change now.
So are you keeping your day job at Pitt?
Oh, yeah. I mean, I've always relied on teaching as a way to think and as a way to kind of have a ready community, both of students and also of colleagues. So I've always thought of teaching being really central to my creative process. So when I imagine, you know, sitting around, that's a very difficult thing for me to think about in terms of producing poems. I've never gone to conferences or residencies, some of the things that people do in terms of finding time and separating themselves from their daily lives. But maybe now I can think about those things. But certainly teaching will be fundamental and really central to how I continue to write. So I don't even know if I'll take any time off, to tell the truth.
We heard you yesterday on All Things Considered talking about coming to Pittsburgh and the role that Pitt and the city played in shaping you as a poet and really making you a poet. Could you elaborate on, you know, what the city means to you and how it has been reflected in your work?
Sure. And it's clearer in retrospect. I mean, when I grew up in the South, I played sports, and I was a visual artist, so people sort of understood that. But I really thought of my writing as a very private enterprise. The spoken word wasn't even a sort of national movement at the time, and hip-hop was just sort of coming into the fray. So I can't say that, like, a life as a verbal artist was even something I dreamed of. But a professor in the South who was actually from the North said, oh, you should send out some work, and a professor who graduated from the University of Pittsburgh in the 60s suggested I send some work there. And then I met Toy Derricotte, who happened to be in South Carolina doing a reading. So it was just sort of very fortuitous but I really was unprepared. I hadn't had any creative writing classes. I hadn't met really any poets. And so I just pretty much threw myself into the library and into the hip-hop scene and into my classes. And so much of how I identify myself as a poet has to do with those initial things that I saw, which were really diverse communities, Rivers, Andy Warhol, August Wilson, just figures who, for the first time, sort of brought to my attention that you could have a life as a writer and you could live in a place where people thought artists were of value. And so I sort of kind of understood that. I came to understand that, but especially when I moved away and I lived in Ohio and New Orleans and Japan, and those places were great. There were artists there, but it certainly was a different kind of depth to the way artists were viewed in the city. And so the first opportunity I had to come back, I did come back with my wife and daughter.
The history of writers who have connections to Pittsburgh, there's often a pattern of starting out in Pittsburgh and then leaving at the earliest opportunity. I think of like Gertrude Stein and Willa Cather, I think, spent some time and then got out. August Wilson had this sort of complicated relationship with the city for many years. What is it that you see in Pittsburgh, you know, coming in as a Southerner, as an outsider, that's maybe helped you see the city in a different way?
I would say first, I think that maybe you do have to leave home to appreciate home. And in fact, at the end of this month, we have a writer who I had no idea she was from Pittsburgh, this writer, Lucy Brock-Broido, who teaches at Columbia University, and I followed her work for years and years, and I just happened to see her out somewhere once, and she said, "No one's ever invited me back to Pittsburgh. I grew up in Squirrel Hill." And I was like, "What, really?" So she's another one. There's so many writers with connections, John Edgar Wideman. So for me, it is really about coming into the city as an outsider, and I think seeing things here that the people on the ground here see, but certainly part of a writer's life sometimes involves a journey. I would never want to go home, for example, back to the South, but I do write quite a bit about the South. So, I mean, I think everybody has a different relationship to their landscape and to their home. But for me, as I said, it really is because this is where I identified myself as a writer, and it's where I've developed a writing community, and I would assume that that's possible for people in other places. And I certainly think that it has everything to do with me discovering writing here and finding it to be a place that, for me at least, is very generative. And I think for the people who live here, for my spouse and for my teachers, and the people who've left, I hope that they found inspiration elsewhere. But I think many of those people who've left have also kept Pittsburgh sort of at the forefront in terms of their inspirations and their sort of body of work.
I know that you're involved in or have been involved with the August Wilson Center recovery team, and I wonder if this is good news for that effort as well. You have a little juice maybe that wasn't there before.
I hope so. The issue with that process was that it was so much about the building and about real estate. And so when I was invited by Janera Solomon, who runs the Kelly Strayhorn, just to kind of come on board, I didn't have any kind of interest in a board membership or what 5 years or 3 years from now would look like. I just thought, well, surely you have to have some writers and artists involved. And so it's me and it's another local artist, Jasiri X, and then some really important people. But primarily my interest is as an artist. So if this means that the people who will make the decision can see that, yeah, writers and artists value this space and want to be a part of the conversation, then certainly I hope that has some bearing on it. But that is really my role, just as an artist and really as a citizen, not even necessarily as a professor, but first a citizen, a fan of August Wilson, and an artist who's decided to live in the city. So I hope it has some bearing. And I think I was hoping that before this happened, which is to say, yeah, we're here, we're at the table. I surely can't represent all of the artists in the city, but even a little bit of representation, I think, is better than none.
I mean, do you see yourself continuing to have a place at that table in either of the two scenarios or however many scenarios for how it plays out real estate-wise?
Not really. I mean, it is a kind of like feet in front of me thing. At this point, I'm just really most interested in making sure that it remains a cultural center, it remains a place for artists to be able to go. And it's really hard to see that if it's a hotel. But in terms of what it was and the support of the foundations really suggests that it can continue to be a place for artists. I'll say this. This is something that came up in this process when we just talked about why was it of value. And it goes back to your previous question. I just said, what would it take to make the artists who have left the city stay? So what would it take to make the next August Wilson remain in Pittsburgh as opposed to leaving Pittsburgh? And that was, for me, was a really fundamental question for the mission of the center, both going forward and the future. So I don't know if how much of a role I would play in that kind of question, but I certainly think it's a question everybody has to ask. This is even true for Kyle Abraham, who won a MacArthur last year. How do you make these artists feel that this is also a place where they can stay and have a kind of objective view of the city, be critical of the city even? I think August Wilson had some dimensions of critique in his work, mm-hmm. and also show a kind of complicated love for the city. So for me, that's really my primary interest. And, you know, it's a kind of a philosophical question. It's an aesthetic question. It's not necessarily a political question, but I sort of have deliberately tried not to think too much about the political implications of the space and tried to keep my role as an artist and as a fan and as a citizen in the front of my mind through that.
I mean, what does August Wilson mean to you as an artist, as a Black writer, someone with a close connection with the Pittsburgh community? What do you take from August Wilson?
Right. Well, I'm going to say two things here. And part of this is a response to my how I think of myself as a writer. And I think about this generally for people, that so many of our interests really begin at our feet, as opposed to sort of being pulled down in a kind of abstract way. So many of my political attitudes, aesthetic attitudes, really come from experience. And then sometimes I try to challenge them. Sometimes I try to shape them into something more complicated. So I say all that to say, when I got to Pittsburgh, maybe the first week that I was in Pittsburgh, a friend who'd grown up here took me to the Hill, and he introduced me to Rob Penny, who was one of August Wilson's great friends when he grew up. And we talked about August, and he talked about him having started out as a poet. And Rob was a playwright, and he called some other poets who lived in the city. So my relationship to August really began there, in terms of really being mentored by both the people who mentored him and the people who were his friends. So I'd read August in South Carolina. I used to carry around anthologies, and I'd read Ma Rainey's Black Bottom. So I was certainly interested in who he was as an icon. But my real relationship to him came very much in terms of the people who knew him. And the joke was always that he started out as a poet and didn't quite succeed as a poet, but discovered playwriting. And I'll also say that I was always really interested in Rob, because the question for me, even when Rob was alive, was that, you know, he stayed here, he was in the community, he mentored people like me, and he never became what August became. And so I always thought, well, if he'd left Pittsburgh, would he have been a kind of August Wilson figure? But then we wouldn't have him here. And so the kinds of sacrifices that artists sometimes make, which go unmarked, but, you know, I'm here talking about him. And so my relationship to August as an artist predated my arrival in Pittsburgh, but certainly what happened here in Pittsburgh is I came to understand who he was as an individual, even finding out that Cobby Conham Organization, which I've been a part of for my entire poet's life, Toy Derricott at the University of Pittsburgh, started this organization. We learned after his death that he'd been giving money to Cobby Conham for many, many years, and with really no one ever knowing that he supported this organization, August did. And so those kinds of things, which aren't necessarily in the biographies or newspapers or plays, are really the things that I've taken from him in terms of understanding an artist's role, an artist's obligation, an artist's love for community.
What do you see the role of poetry being now in American culture in 2014? And do you see yourself playing a part in making it more accessible, more popular?
I was on CNN after I won the National Book Award, and that's one of those questions big media really, they like to ask. A woman said, yeah, what do you do to make more people like poetry? And my response, and this is especially true in Pittsburgh, is that when I go out, the seats are full, whether I'm in the audience or whether I'm on the stage, whether I'm going to Hemingway's in Oakland or the Mattress Factory or City of Asylum, I never feel like I'm in a space and I'm the only person sitting there that loves poetry. So I don't know what the other people are doing. They might be home watching the Bucks, or they might be at the opera, and I think that's great. So my question is never how to get the people who have found the arts elsewhere to the poetry. I just hope that they found it elsewhere, because the people who come to poetry are the people that are responding to poetry and the people that are being engaged by poetry. And I'm certainly one of those people. I mean, I'm interested in opera and I'm interested in the Steelers as well. So, of course, the more kind of cultural relationships you have, the better. But my desire is never really to convert people. I just hope that people can find what we're doing. And in my own work, it's the same. I try not to think about like a kind of audience with a capital A or the masses. I just try to think about the poem in front of me. I try to be honest. I try to make discoveries, and I hope that it connects with other people, one person at a time, essentially.
If you wouldn't mind reading a little bit from one of your pieces, if you've got something handy that speaks to, you know, Pittsburgh and what it means to you.
Oh, yeah, see, that's going to be tricky. Let me see. What do I have here? So I could tell you a sort of a setup story for this poem. And again, what I really try to do is have an experience just in my waking life and look for opportunities to transform that and make discoveries. And so one of the great stories that especially emerges in Pittsburgh around February, Black History Month, is the story of the Pitt Writers who took over the computer center in maybe that was 69, 68. And so Jack Daniels, there are a bunch of people involved. Maybe Salahuddin even was involved with this. And so there was just a February where I was, again, in the audience hearing someone tell that story. And so it prompted a poem. And the poem really began thinking about, why am I always hearing this story? And it becomes something else. So it's a longer poem, and maybe I should read the end of it. "We weren't going to be colored. We weren't going to be Negro," the man says. And I'm thinking, every time I hear this story, it's the one telling the story who's the hero. "Hush now," Harriet Tubman probably said near dawn, pointing a finger black enough to be her pistol barrel toward the future. Or pointing a pistol barrel black enough to be her finger at the mouth of some starved, stammering slave, and then lifting her head to listen for something that no one but her could hear. What I'd say about that poem is it's really trying to explore transformation, and the line that always sort of prompts me, the line that really triggered the entire poem, is every time I hear this story, it's the one telling the story. That's the hero. And so depending on the inflection, that's either a sarcastic comment, like, every time I hear this story, it's the one telling the story, that's the hero. Or it's a kind of comment of praise. Every time I hear this story, it's the one telling the story, that's the hero. So again, like, those kinds of inflections are really of interest to me in storytelling and in poetry and in terms of human feeling, because that's essentially how I felt hearing this great story of Pittsburgh contemporary history. Both are kind of like, not again, and also like, yeah, you can't tell it enough. So I tried to kind of reach for that kind of complexity in the poem.
Does your work need to be read aloud? Do you think of it when you write as something that will be spoken or read on a page? Does it matter?
Well, I do think of them as simultaneous, both in the air and on the page. What's interesting about that poem and the challenge of it is that it really has everything to do with your own sensibility. So in some ways, when I read the poem, I can't take advantage of that inflection because I have to make a decision about how to inflect that statement. But if you're reading it, it just has everything to do with your own sensibility. If you're inclined towards sarcasm, you might hear it as a sarcastic line. If you're inclined towards a kind of earnestness, you would hear it as an earnest line. And I get it both ways. And so people really want me to nail that down when they've read it. Like, how do I hear that line? And I say, how you hear it is right. And I like that slipperiness. But generally speaking, certainly everything that I write is meant to be in the air and meant to travel, you know, simultaneously on the page.
Well, thanks so much for reading that.
No problem.
Congratulations on the fellowship. We're really excited to see what happens next.
Thank you. It's a great honor, and I'm happy to share it with Pittsburgh.
MacArthur Grant recipient Terrence Hayes talking with WESA Morning Edition host Josh Rollerson. Thank you for listening to today's edition of Essential Pittsburgh. If you missed any portion of the program or would like to revisit past segments, you can go to our website at wesa.fm. Until next time, I'm Paul Guggenheimer. Have a great weekend, everyone.